everyone. This is Adam Shark, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode 394 of the podcast. Hello. This episode is a bunch of fun. We have the director of content at Mubi. You know, Mubi, the streaming on-demand website, which rotates films every day. There's a new title added and a title is removed. So at any point, there'll be 30 films available for streaming. And he will be joining us, as well as a monologuist, actor, performance artist, whatever you want to call Josh Kornbluth. Now, here's the thing why I invited him on, and that's because like 15 years ago, a friend of myself, she invited me to go see this one-man show by the monologuist Josh Kornbluth. I didn't know who he was. All I knew is the show was called Ben Franklin Unplugged. I had no idea, but I went. I was at this place, I think PS 122. It was in the Village. We went. I had a great time. This guy was very interesting and funny and original. And I had a great time. And so flash forward to last fall, there I am at the Woodstock Film Festival, and I see Josh sitting there at a table by himself. And, you know, I thought, you know, what the heck? It turns out, of course, that they've taken a subsequent monologue of his called Love and Taxes and turned that one into a film. They've adapted it into a film. And I thought, I didn't get to see it, but I thought, well, still, maybe he'll be open to talking. And he was. We had a really nice time. So we're going to talk about that. I've since seen Love and Taxes, and it turns out that it's opening this Friday, March the 3rd, in New York, and you'll have an opportunity to see it. He has a bunch of shows he's done on many themes. Generally, it's they become personal, of course, on some level. And this is, I think, his second one that he has adapted into a film. Again, it's called Love and Taxes. So we'll be talking to Josh in just a little bit. But first, let's get into my conversation with the director of content at Mubi, Daniel Kasman. Talking with Daniel Kasman from Mubi. What's your proper title? By
the way? Director of content.
Director.
Very uninteresting title for a film company.
Well, it is the parlance. And now that if you use that term, people know what you're talking about. So.
Well, they sort of know what you're talking about. You say content, but you could be meaning a tweet or a feature length.
Well, you know, I'm sorry. Do you work out of Washington? I don't. So how long have you been with Mubi?
I've been at Mubi now for 9 years. It started in 2007 under the original name was The Auteurs, and it was it launched as a streaming video service that, much like today, focuses on international classic auteur film.
Yes,
but more as a catalog service, much like Netflix is now. Mm-hmm. And 3 or 4 years ago, we shifted to the way we present films now, which is less like a catalog or a store and more yep. like a curated selection, very small selection.
Yeah, yeah. Well, tell me what movie, where that name came from.
Oh, that is definitely like an internet word that has, you know, no meaning and every meaning. We wanted mm-hmm. to create a word that, you know, when we started The Auteurs, we really loved that name as a brand and as a sort of vision for
yeah.
content. But you know, it was a company that was focused specifically in the U.S. and the U.K. and a little bit in France, where that word has meaning and can be spelled.
Auteur.
Yeah. But once we wanted to show films wider than that, and even since 2007, we've been showing films globally, not just in those countries, mm-hmm. we found that was not a term or a word that could be spelled easily if you're in Argentina or Japan or Mumbai. And so we mm-hmm. wanted to pick a word that, you know, anybody could say and anybody could spell and, you know, has that kind of reasoning behind it. Mm. It's not some clever
Japanese.
Acronym. It does sound Japanese, yeah.
Now that I think about yeah. it, but it could be any number of...
Exactly.
It has almost also a little German sort of...
Mubi.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I was watching Hacksaw Ridge last night, finally catching up to some, you know,
Oscar contenders.
Contenders, yeah, and just things that are curiosities. And it was really delighting in how, I mean, you know, if you have a really violent story to tell,
Mel Gibson, despite his foibles, which we could list with no problem, but and I grappled with as a Semitic person. I was grappling with the idea of even wanting to ever see another movie by him, but just decided to check it out anyway, and really enjoyed it. Actually, it was really entertaining. I mean, there is a lot of very, very violent, a lot of violence depicted, and it occurred to me as I was watching how it's they just of course they did use the terms. I think we're at the American soldiers used terms like Japs and Nips.
Sure.
We know that that's what they called them. So to try to reinvent that would be inaccurate and fiction. But just to see just how many were just how the Japanese were portrayed, and it was all through the POV of Americans. So it was accurate. It was just shocking in a way to see an unapologetic story, war story, because it all takes place on Okinawa. So I got sidetracked. But that's not necessarily a film that would be on MUBI, but it's a rotation, essentially, right? Every day you add a film and you remove a film.
Yeah, correct. So we only have 30 films available at any time in any country. The lineup is different in every country due to the sort of vagrances of territorial rights and stuff like that.
Very
boring topic.
Can you tell me, though, also, like you mentioned London and France.
Yes.
Well, London and Paris, or England and France, I suppose. So there was an office of MUBI in London.
Yeah, our headquarters are in London, actually.
Is that where MUBI or the auteurs started?
No, we started in Palo Alto. We were founded in Palo Alto, and then a couple of years after that, we moved to San Francisco. But not so long later, we also opened an office in London because the kinds of film rights we're acquiring, which are digital rights. Some of them involve dealing with local rights owners. So here in the U.S., I talk to distributors like Kino Lorber or Zeitgeist or Magnolia, but also many of these rights, when someone has a new film, the rights to show that film digitally may be sold in the U.S. or a larger territory like France or Germany or the U.K., but then maybe they don't sell the rights to show that film on streaming digital to any of South America. And so the person who retains those rights, sometimes it's the filmmaker or the producer, but most often for these kind of films that we're talking about, they're international sales agents, and most of those sales agents are located in Europe. So it made sense for us to open an office in Europe.
Yeah. And is that the only European office then, I suppose?
Yes.
Okay.
We have scattered freelancers and developers and consultants sort of around because we want to make sure that we're in touch with sort of cinephilia around the world.
Sure.
But yeah, most of the offices.
The cinef hotspots.
Hotspots, exactly.
Around the world. It makes sense. So it started in Palo Alto, and then you said to San Francisco. So it's sort of it was always kind of this hybrid of new tech and cinema.
Yeah, exactly. Our CEO has a entrepreneurial MIT background, and so he sort of brought his technical expertise and hired film staff to sort of, as you say, combine the technical aspect with the artistic aspect, which is very necessary in this world because we really want to make sure that we're presenting these films as intended, as beautifully as possible, et cetera, because especially when we got started, and even now, I think the sort of larger companies that are showing films, whether you're talking about an art film or a mainstream film, don't really care about aspect ratio, the encoding quality of sound, mono versus stereo versus surround sound. Like for them, they're just trying to get the content out there, to use the word we used at the beginning, content. Whereas for us, we really want to caretake these movies and make sure they're being presented in the way the filmmakers, the producers intend them to be seen. And that takes a real focus on the technology side as well.
Right. Nobody cares more than filmmakers, and to have some is people in place that really care, like that projectionist that whose heart is really you're like kind of like projectionists.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, certainly.
Because the old world projectionists, you'll be hard pressed to find people that care more about how the film looks,
exactly.
And how much you honor the filmmaker's intentions. When you read lots of film biographies over time, you always hear about those filmmakers that traveled around to the movie theaters back in the day.
Okay, there's like people like Kubrick who would call, when he was, even sort of living in the UK, he would call the cinema showing 2001 in New York and say, is the volume high enough? What was the audience like? What aspect ratio you're projecting it in, things like that.
Yeah, I've curated my own film series or various series in different venues, and I did a film, this is an example of what you're talking about, where I did a more of a talk than it was, even though we showed his film, John Turturro's, one of his directed films, in this case, Romance and Cigarettes, was that what it was called?
Yeah.
And it's, I guess you could call it a musical. Mm-hmm. And anyway, but he came and he sat in the back and he was shouting louder for the first minutes of the film.
It's funny, like, you say that because, whenever we, we show movies online, of course, but we often try to collaborate with institutions or cinemas to do sort of one-off special screenings and so forth. And really the requests that we get most often from the filmmakers we deal with on how best to present their work in a theatrical setting is always louder. Like when we were showing Paul Thomas Anderson's documentary, Janoon, he was like, when you take this movie to cinemas, I want it loud. I don't remember what the number was. I was like, I want it 9 out of 10 on the volume control.
On the old Richter. Yeah. Well, you don't have to worry about the old people getting offended and leaving the Janoon, because it's just, they're not going to be in that theater, I'm going to guess anyway.
Probably not.
But, any film. I was going to say especially a musical, but it doesn't matter. There is sound design, and there's an intended level to it, just like you don't want the wrong aspect ratio. It's the audio version of an aspect ratio.
Yeah.
It's the volume, certain volume, like any recipe, you can get, you can pick up things you wouldn't otherwise.
You're right. I mean, many filmmakers pay as much attention to their sound mix personally as they do to the cinematography.
Yeah. I mean, another way to look at it is, I mean, even though we are all past the point of accepting this idea that we're going to be watching films on phones and tablets and laptops, as well as,
your
various screens. Well, yeah. But it's not until you do see it projected, one manner or another, on a big screen, do you realize just how much information you're losing just
absolutely.
By not being able to see it, and all the light that comes, that is required.
And not just projected, but projected on film. I've definitely seen films on beautiful sort of quote-unquote 4K DCP restorations, and they look beautiful and pristine, and then I see sort of a beat-up print of that sometime later, and it just, the luminosity and the colors are different. I mean, it's a different experience. Also, I think being in a cinema with people, I think, everyone tries to find this sort of essentialist term of what cinema is or isn't, is a streaming TV show cinema, if it's good enough or bad enough. I mean, for me, cinema is about a collective community experience watching moving image art. So, seeing things in a cinema, above all, is about being next to somebody, even if it's just one other person in that cinema with you who's laughing or not laughing or crying or not crying. I think that's sort of what makes a movie a movie.
And if you're at the Alamo Draft House eating dinner,
right? That too, spilling your beer, eating your nachos.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, you brought up 4K restoration or what have you, but I don't know if you noticed online, but on Wednesday I'm doing a panel over.
Yes.
Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I'm inviting you. Tomorrow night, actually. Jeez, I better clear my plans and prepare. Yeah. It should be an interesting conversation. So we were talking about auteurs. We're talking about the types of films. Hmm. And you're, again, you're a creative...
Director of content.
Director of content.
So does that include
programming? Or?
Yeah, so it's an interesting position because we're in a digital space and we're not an actual cinema or an actual distributor, although actually now we are distributing films theatrically,
which
I can talk about a bit later.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But it's an interesting position because it's definitely an acquisitions position, so it's a position where I go out and talk to film companies and choose the films that they own that we want to show, and then it's also a programming position, much like a festival or a cinematheque, where then once we have acquired those films, how do we order them? How do we place them? How do we present them? How do we contextualize them for our audience? So it's a bit of both of those things.
Mm-hmm. You were beginning to talk about acquiring theatrical. Is that what you meant?
Yeah. So, for us, we've always been a digital first company, but we've also really prided ourselves in championing the films that we think need to be championed, especially films, smaller films, artier films, more independent films, maybe older films that have been forgotten, the kind of films that Netflix or Amazon don't really care about supporting so much. And, so for us, we go out to, I have several colleagues at the Berlin Film Festival right now who are looking at films in the competition, and in the smaller section is trying to find stuff that fit, our service, fit our audience, stuff that we can bring uniquely. And we put a lot of effort into tracking these films down, to acquiring the rights, to then marketing them. And as we talked about earlier, the films are only on the platform for a short period of time. Each film that we introduce is only on the platform for 1 month. This is purposeful to give a smaller, tighter selection and give a sort of time-based, inspiration, a context to watch the film in, or yeah. in some case, an anxiety to I have to watch right. this film before it goes offline.
Yeah.
But for us, in a way, on the film team, it's a little heartbreaking to put so much effort into these films we love and then for them to disappear after 30 yeah. days. And so we yeah. kind of wanted to expand our support for these kind of films further than our own online platform, and that extends into the reach of putting them out theatrically and then on Mubi, but then also on other platforms as well, because after they run for 30 days on Mubi, they can definitely find a home on Amazon or Netflix, but we'd like to launch them on Mubi. So last year in the UK, we released 5 films theatrically, really great films like Miguel Gomez's Arabian Nights or Matthew Almeric's The Blue Room or Eugene Green's Son of Joseph. In the US, we released a really beautiful debut film by a new French filmmaker called Baden Baden. And the next film we're releasing, both in the U.S. and in the U.K., is in April. It's called The Happiest Day in the Life of Olli Mäki. It's a Finnish film that won a prize in Cannes last year, a sort of boxing romance. It's a great film.
A boxing romance. Yeah. Well, Rocky was a boxing romance, I suppose you could argue. In the great tradition. And so I guess in other words, there could be a distribution here for a film, let's say, like you mentioned Arabian Nights. Mm-hmm. I believe Kino Lorber distributed in the United States. I'm thinking the theatrical.
You're correct, yes.
Okay. But they weren't distributing it in the UK.
Correct. And so
you've got the presence there.
Exactly.
So you have that. You already have a bit of an infrastructure there to do.
Yeah, exactly. We've actually done more theatrical releases in the UK because it's a smaller country. The asking price for films to purchase those rights are far more affordable than the U.S., where, you know, no matter how obscure or experimental the film, it seems like the film producers think they'll make hundreds of thousands of dollars for their film in the U.S. And so it's always a bit of a challenge, especially for us as a new company in the theatrical market to sort of, you know, compete in that way. So we're really happy to snag this prize winner in Cannes, because for us that'll be our first sort of big release in the U.S. But, you know, in Berlin right now, we're hopefully to get something else that we can do later this year as well.
Mm-hmm. What is the audience's for marketing? Mm-hmm. Speaking of, is there a completely different approach to marketing in the U.K. than there would be here? How different is it?
Well, it's not really my
expertise.
That's my expertise, but no, it's the same. Especially as a digital company, we're always sort of digital first and sort of marketing. It's different when you're doing a theatrical campaign versus just doing.
That's kind of what I was getting at. A movie like Arabian Nights, or what you mentioned, Baden Baden, or one of the others.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm just wondering, like, how what that experience is like. And you've done some distribution here, also. I mean, sorry, excuse me, theatricals here as well, right?
Yes.
What was an example?
Just that one, Baden Baden. We did it in November.
You're right.
I think when we do our digital releases, whether exclusive or not, we tend to focus specifically on digital marketing. And then obviously when we're doing theatrical releases, there's sort of a more traditional route to go as well that combines trailers and posters and, you know, physical world things that we tend to avoid when doing specifically digital campaigns.
And these art films, or you know, essentially they're art films. So are they? You're primarily showing them in London. I'm sure when you do a theatrical, right? You're not.
No. Quite farther than that. I mean,
so that's the difference.
UK is a bit like the US too, in that you know there'll be a handful of small art theaters in Manchester or in this town or that town, and it may be the one theater that has 4 screens, and we you know, but we still put that film there. It's not like I wouldn't think of the UK in the way that we think a limited release here is. New York and LA only, and then nothing else. It's like, you know, you start there and then you go to the smaller cities.
Right. You kind of test market them in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Like, for example, The Blue Room, Matthew Almeric's film
that I
put out
last
year, that was in 40 cinemas in the UK.
40 cinemas?
Yeah.
I guess
if you had asked me if I knew that there was 40 art cinemas in the UK, I would have said I did not know that, but now I
know. Well, it doesn't surprise me. You know, there seems to be more of an emphasis, I suppose, on true, I don't know. I'm going to start to
speculate
and make broad
remarks. Go for it.
But it seems like, I guess my original thought was that it's even though maybe the UK is a much smaller country than the US, for instance, it still comes down to, you know, particular little pockets, you know, where you show the film. It's not like you're trying to distribute it. Yeah, exactly. It's the same approach in terms of where you're playing the films.
Yes, exactly.
You know, if you have an art cinema that's been around for many, many decades, it's because there's an audience going to it.
Absolutely.
You know, so, yeah.
We hope.
Willing to take certain risks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
That's terrific. And so, as you say, every day. So if you subscribe, and there is, you have a trial subscription.
Yeah, yeah. If you go to Mubi.com, it's 1 week for free.
And MUBI. And just,
MUBI, yes.
You got a week trial.
Exactly.
And if you're the kind of person that likes to relax in front of, you know, whether it's your TV or, by the way, is there an app?
Yeah, there's plenty of apps. Whatever device you can use, yeah.
At this point,
Apple TV or Fire TV and Roku and all sorts of things.
So movies on all that?
We're on most of those things, yeah.
Okay, so that's good. So if you're sitting down, settling down, and you have a glass of wine, which goes pairs nicely with...
Any movie goes well with the glass.
However, here's my thing. If it's day 30,
yes,
and you're putting on, you know, the Trojan Horse or some film like that... Don't put it on at 10 in the evening with your wine, because basically what's going to happen is you're going to doze off. Now, this happens to me. You know, I'm excited, but it's the last day, so I've put the time aside. I'm going to watch it tonight because it's not going to be available tomorrow. And then I doze off, and then it's gone.
It's true. You know? It's heartbreaking. This is the morality of the film experience.
Can I make a phone call? And to Mubi and ask for an...
We certainly revive films. I mean, what we like to do is we like to put films in the right context.
Well, you can see all the traffic, too.
Yes, exactly. You know, I mean, if we get requests all the time. I mean, that certainly is something that's not a rare experience. People, you know, I myself procrastinate films and then watch half of it, and then I realize that I forgot to resume it, and now it's gone. Yeah. And
can you, by the way, answer me? Maybe you can't talk about this. Maybe it's one of the dark secrets of digital exhibit.
We try to be pretty transparent.
Can you see that specific information in terms of who's not completed watching?
Yeah.
We
can see if someone's completed the film and if they've not completed the film.
You can drill down to a subscriber?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's useful data. Who finishes films, at what point they stop, things like that.
Interesting.
It's very useful.
Yeah. Is there any patterns like that have surprised you? Ever?
No, you know
what?
I mean,
on the spot.
Yes and no, but I think speaking of dark secrets, I think one of the darkest, but also maybe most obvious secrets of film history in general, I don't just mean digital distribution, is that no one really knows why a film is popular or not popular, or a hit or a not hit. There's a lot of good guesswork.
Isn't that good?
Yeah,
that's a good thing.
I think it's amazing.
Otherwise, we wouldn't have to have jobs.
You just
have algorithms to tell.
You're right. I mean, I suppose Netflix is trying to do that with their original content, like basing what they're producing on the trends that they're seeing. But you never know why those trends are happening or where they're coming from. And then it's a lot of guesswork.
And they're not always, they don't always work.
And they don't always work.
You know, and like, for instance, I read early on how, you know, Netflix did this, you know, rather elaborate study on you know, Kevin Spacey was just so big popular.
Right,
his movies were popular on Netflix. So they decided to finance his House of Cards, exactly. And that was the origin of that. And then I've heard that that's been dispelled, or that wasn't necessarily okay. Either, I don't know. I guess in the end, it worked. So
yes.
it's a rare case where they've got milked it for many seasons. Is that ever... I don't suppose Mubi has ever considered doing something along those lines.
Original content? It's something that we're always thinking of. A couple years ago, we produced a short film by the Palme d'Or winner, Apichatpong Weerasethakul, who did Uncle Bumi.
Uncle Bumi.
A really wonderful filmmaker. And that was a really great
Well, because he did have a follow-up film last year, right?
Yeah, Cemetery of Splendor, which kind of fell under the radar, but is a really beautiful film. Highly recommend it. But yeah, we had a great experience doing that, and it's not something that... I think it's, for us, it's a bit like what we're doing now with theatrical. It's not theatrical releases. It's not something that's in our blood, but it's something that sort of fits very naturally our inclinations and our vision. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's something we do down the line. Not television, of course, that doesn't make any sense, but definitely supporting the kinds of filmmakers and films that we like to a greater degree than simply quote unquote releasing their films.
The marketplace, we refer to Netflix, which I don't think is your competition. I don't know if you look at it that way. But one thing is, you know, there's a shortage of there's not a lot of high-quality art films and international films, for one thing, on there. Or they're just very buried.
You're astute to notice that, because there used to be, or at least there used to be an okay amount. Netflix used to take a lot of art films and independent films, and I think they've. I would assume that based on the data they're seeing, they're no longer acquiring that. So I forget what the stat was, but I think last year they you know admitted that they you know had 2/3 the amount of films they did that year than they did you know the previous year.
They're just really?
Less and less films. Huh. Amazon Prime's a bit the same as well. And you're right. I mean, it's sad for larger audiences, but it's certainly an opportunity for us who've always been supporting these films in the first place.
Well, yeah, because I all of a sudden fell off with my all the different programming or rather screening committees and other work for other. And I all of a sudden didn't have to watch tons of movies for other people so I could watch whatever I wanted. Exactly. And my list just sort of just shrunk
Starts
to nothing.
Yeah.
To nothing. And I was able to watch a bunch of foreign titles that had been sitting there for a long time that I really wanted to focus on. And now I'm like... Oh. Back on, you know, so it's a great. So what I'm doing is that what I'm recommending people listening to do is to visit Mubi.com and to immerse yourself in fantastic cinema. So thank you very much for sitting down.
Oh, my pleasure,
Daniel. It's nice meeting you or talking with you. This is not our first time meeting, but yeah, it's great. Great to hear more about Mubi.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Again, Josh Kornbluth is a very creative individual, very funny, very original. If you have an opportunity to ever see one of his works by him, go and do that. I highly recommend you go see him. He's in that great tradition of monologuists like Anna Deavere Smith and Eric Bogosian. You have John Leguizamo. So many wonderful individuals going all the way back, of course, to the father, at least contemporarily speaking, Spalding Gray himself. Anyway, this is again called Love and Taxes, the film. It's directed by Josh's brother, Jacob Kornbluth, and written by Josh, and acted, the main actor is Josh playing himself. Harry Shearer has a walk-on role. Robert Reich, yes, the former Secretary of Labor for Bill Clinton. This is his first acting role, as far as I know, and he's in it, and he's actually quite natural and good in this film. But anyway, it's essentially comes from the mind of this zany, funny, unique individual named Josh Kornbluth, and I'm very proud and happy to introduce Josh Kornbluth on FilmWax Radio.
Some time ago, I had kind of an insight into myself, a realization that the central challenge of my adult life was to be found in tax law. I had just completed the run of my first autobiographical monologue. It was about growing up in New York with my communist parents. Now, this goes back to a time when I was working full-time as a secretary for Bob, this really great tax attorney.
I was at your show last night. I really liked it.
The cleverest little bit was that joke where you say, you haven't done your taxes in 7 years.
I actually haven't done my taxes in 7 years.
Josh Kornbluth, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure.
It's very last minute.
Cool.
Have you done a podcast before?
Yes, I think so. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, that's mostly what people say.
Yeah.
Well... We're here at Woodstock Film Festival, and you have a new work, which is in a festival version of it, a festival print, right? Would you say or cut?
Oh, no, it's the movie.
It's okay, very good, and it's called Love and Taxes.
Yeah,
right, and it is it's narrative,
mm-hmm.
And it's a comedy.
Yes.
Is it safe to say?
It's a comedy for sure. Yeah.
You're a comedian, one of the things.
Well, I
spoken word.
Well,
performance.
I started to call myself a monologist because that allows me to get serious too.
Let me ask you a question because this is nagging at me.
Monologist or monologist? Is that your question?
No.
Oh, okay.
But we'll save that for later.
Okay.
No. Here's why I think you caught my eye and why I've been kind of a little bit focused on getting you to talk, because I think I saw you perform in New York City once.
Oh.
Years ago. Is it possible?
It sounds like me.
You did a show, is it possible, on an American historical figure?
Yes, Ben Franklin.
Is it possible
unplugged.
That it was Ben Franklin?
Cool,
sorry,
that was me.
I just banged the table. I saw your show. This is at least 10, 15 years ago.
Yeah, that would have been at PS 122.
Yes.
Yeah.
What
that was
you,
me.
Do you remember vaguely what year that was?
They all blend together now.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
At this point. I think we're probably roughly in the same ballpark.
I'm 56.
I'm a little younger.
Yeah.
But
no, when you get to my age, it'll all just start falling apart.
It's already, I'm there. Well. Trust me. Well, no, that, I don't remember the specifics of it because the synapses, as we were just sort of saying, mm-hmm. take a little longer to, you know, kick in. But I do recall my response to the show was being a nice surprise, not knowing really about you till my friend Rachel mm-hmm. took me to the show.
Yeah.
And remember really enjoying the experience. So,
are you and Rachel still friends? Or?
No. Yes, no, we are. As a matter of fact, I just had a little bit of a birthday gathering last weekend, and she was there. Yeah, so I'm still good friends with her. I've known her since 1987.
Cool. So it's it was definitely after 1987 that
way
you saw
after
me.
Yeah. In fact, I would say it's probably closer to the maybe it had to be in the first part of the first decade.
Probably, yeah.
Right?
Most likely. Pretty much. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. You're right.
It can't be more than 15 years ago.
I don't think.
Could it? Maybe.
About 15 years ago, maybe.
Okay, all right. Well, we're wasting too much time on that. But it was a great show.
Thank you.
And it was just so, it's very just nuanced and funny really clever. And it was personal. And you know.
Exactly, yeah. That's why I do. My stuff is all really personal, and Love and Taxes is the same way.
Is it? And you're obviously the star of that.
I'm the star. You know, we had a lot of big movie stars audition for the
sure,
role.
But ultimately.
Ultimately, my brother made the call. The director, Jacob, made the call. Yes, I'm the star.
Did you write it?
I wrote it.
Okay. So you wrote and act in it?
And I wrote and acted in it. My brother, Jacob, directed it.
Jacob Kornbluth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's adapted from a monologue that I did with my theatrical collaborator many years, David Dower.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Is it that the film, the technology, ease of making a film, relatively speaking, compared to 15 years ago, let's say, would you have not maybe have thought about doing the Benjamin Franklin piece as a film piece? Maybe, you know, or in terms of a narrative version of it, you may have shot it, the performance.
Right.
But now it's like, oh, well, we could do this.
Yeah, no, it's still really hard to make a movie. As it happens, my brother Jacob and I made a previous film. This is our second film, Love and Taxes. Our first film was called Haiku Tunnel, and we made it in 2000. I didn't hear you. There's a guy pointing at me who's on the phone, and I'm also deaf. So he's pointing at me. He could have been cursing me out. This man. In fact, he probably was.
This is a local phenomenon where people gesture to you.
There's a smiling woman.
Here, there's just lots of people gesticulating and articulating. But I have to say,
it's a very friendly place here in Woodstock, and it is. It's a hospitality suite. So so it would be weird if it was a hostility suite.
That's back down in the
That would be
New
for
York.
New York. Yeah, New York. So, so we made this movie Haiku Tunnel, which is based on another one-man show of mine.
Okay.
And it played at Sundance in 2001, and it came out.
Is that a good film festival? I don't know.
I found it a little too independent. My taste is more commercial, than Sundance.
I can tell.
It got distributed and stuff. So,
nice.
And we did that on film. You know, that was, you know, and we made it. We made Love and Taxes, our new movie, the same way, which is in terms of financially, which is just raising money from local investors and making it really, really cheaply in the Bay Area. But yeah, I guess technically, technologically, it's a bit easier. But Love and Taxes also, it's pretty ambitious. I would like to make for the listeners, you know, who are looking to invest in my next film. You know.
Yeah. Oh, they're probably listening now.
No, I think, you know, it's probably getting out checkbooks now, anxious, holding. Come on, Josh, give us more.
The name of my podcast is called Seed Money.
Cool.
So you're on the right place.
That's why, because I couldn't find it originally. It was under agricultural podcasts originally.
That's right.
Indeed. But anyhow, I'd like to maybe make, this just came up last night, actually, but I'd maybe like to make Ben Franklin, the piece you saw, as a movie.
Really?
No, but right now, I have an actual movie, Love and Taxes, that we actually finished. And that one took 7 years, so I should really be very careful.
What you say.
What I plan.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of interesting. You're probably closer to Ben Franklin's age now.
I'm closer to Ben Franklin's age.
Thing I could say.
I'm closer to Franklin's age now than I was when we began this conversation. As are you.
That's true.
As are you.
Well, I realize how ridiculous what I said was. Of course you are, but I don't have any sense of how old, first of all, Benjamin Franklin was when he was a, for instance, discovering lightning.
But, well, it's actually just, if I may.
Please.
He discovered that, he proved that lightning is electrical.
Right.
Lightning
was already, I know that. Yeah. I was exaggerating.
And as you, your young son is here, who's looking over and making me very homesick for my own young son.
Oh, how old is he?
Older, though, 18.
Okay.
But I'm still homesick for him.
Sure. It's good to know it doesn't stop at 18, like, because I wonder if I'll be just sick of him by the time I can. But I look.
I don't.
He's become the ambassador. He spent so many hours in this place that he can actually direct people to the washrooms and everything else.
Oh, he looks super sweet.
It
just gets, at least in my experience, it just stays beautiful. Just stays, but it, you know, it's shocking. It was shocking when I called home one day and a deep voice answered the phone. Like, literally, it was from one day to the next.
I hope it was him.
It was him, yeah.
When you did the monologue, the Ben Franklin piece,
mm-hmm.
which was going to be called Ben Franklin?
Unplugged.
When you did that, do you remember that your son was alive as a little toddler?
Oh, I remember incredibly. Oh, I actually remember incredibly well. That's why I started working on the piece when my son was in utero.
Oh.
So I know when I began working on the piece. I just don't know when I was in New York with it.
Gotcha, right. Yeah. So how many of these monologues have you done? And
like 8 or 9.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So I guess.
And they're all really different subjects. I mean, I'm in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
They're all around my experience. But as you saw with the Franklin show that you vaguely remember, it's, you know, but it I started going out, especially when I was going to have a kid. I do autobiographical monologues, and I didn't want to put my son in my pieces. I wanted him to have his own, you know, his own life, his own narrative. And
yeah.
So that's why I started doing shows that not only touched on my own experiences, but also involved research into other things. So in the Franklin show, there's a lot of history about Ben Franklin. In Love and Taxes, I actually changed. The one thing I changed in terms of the timing of how things happen in the story, the time frame, is that I actually moved my son's birth so that he would still be not yet born by the end of the piece,
mm-hmm.
so that he wouldn't have to be a character in the piece. So, yeah. Anyhow,
that's it. You're really going out of your way to
what?
You're really going out of your way to.
I did,
to
yeah. And then eventually, I just sort of gave in. And then since my son and my wife are the center of my life, you know, I couldn't not talk about having a son. But I don't like tell cute stories about him, stuff like that in my shows. You know,
you can save it for the podcast.
I'll save it for the podcast. he's really cute.
So okay, well, let's talk about Love and Taxes. What is this one about?
It's
I want to say, by the way, just as a disclaimer. Normally, if I sit with somebody, I would have seen the film, if not your last film as well, your last and first one. But I have not.
You would have dived into my oeuvre.
I would have dived and engulfed and digested all of it. But you, Brian Newman a bit, who's a producer of
he's
it.
He's a producer of the
and,
film. Yeah.
And I ran into him. I hadn't seen him in a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
But so he promised to send me a link. But, you know, I'm hoping the likelihood is it will come through New York City soon enough.
I'm hopeful. We've had so far three. I mean, we just finished this pretty recently, Love and Taxes, and we've had three screenings so far. The fourth will be, as you and I speak, this evening.
That's right.
The first two screenings were in the San Francisco Bay Area, the San Francisco Jewish Film Festival.
Okay.
And so far, all three screenings, people really liked it. So
that's good. But yeah, you must have a sense after doing so many of these. Well, this is your second film.
Right.
So
I really don't have a sense with film. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I do with monologues.
And this one, I was asking, which one, what was this one about?
Right. It's about when I play a guy named Josh who looks like me and talks like me.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens to Josh is that he hasn't filed his taxes in 7 years.
Mm.
And he hasn't really cared. It doesn't really matter to him. He's sort of you know, he was raised, as I was, by, you know, communists. And, you know, so put it to the man. You know, why give money to... You know, mm-hmm. So anyhow, so that's been his rationalization. He hasn't paid taxes, and but then he meets this woman, this beautiful woman, who's a public school teacher.
The love part.
And he falls in love with her, and she gets pregnant, and she then tells him, this woman named Sarah without an H, she tells him that she wants them to be married by mm-hmm. the time the baby is born, but she won't marry him until he solves his horrible tax problems, which at this point are getting worse and worse and worse.
I imagine it must get exponentially.
It does. So it's really bad. So and so what he does initially is try all these ways to get out of his tax problems. But then there's a twist. There's a twist because it really, you know, I don't want to ruin it for your listeners, but then again, you know, maybe I do, but no, it doesn't really.
No,
ruin
no,
it.
Don't.
But I just want. But what I want to
whisper it to me in the microphone, because no.
Well,
microphone.
What I will say is this: It's actually sneakily, trickily. It is a pro-tax movie.
Interesting.
It's a movie about someone finding out that he, who has been railing against the man, you know, blaming everything on the man,
right,
just sort of being on the sidelines, that this person who's been railing against the man is, in fact, the man.
We'll leave it there. No.
Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see it.
Thanks.
It sounds like a really funny and engaging story. And aside from the lead actor. Oh, it's good, though. It's good.
Yeah.
So going back in time here, if we can, you know, how did you get caught up in this scheme of yours in terms of being a monologuist or monologist?
It was really random.
Was it? You weren't like Eric Bogosian didn't like come up to you and put his hand on your shoulder and say, the mantle needs to be.
He did that once, but it was already a mantle. And there was no mantle. He did put his hand. Well, maybe. I don't know. I met him. He's really nice. What happened was I was a copy editor. I was just a mild-mannered copy editor, proofreader at a newspaper in Boston Phoenix.
Mm-hmm. And, sure.
There was a going away party. I was in my 20s. I was aspiring to be a writer or journalist, but I couldn't ever meet a deadline. Couldn't ever. So I didn't really know what to do, and then there was a going-away party for one of the editors who was going to the Village Voice, and just on the spur of the moment, some friends and I decided we were going to do a little skit at the going-away party, which is at a place called the Rat Skellers, a punk bar in Boston. Yeah, it's actually over the Rat and the Hoodoo Barbecue. So we did it, and I'd never performed ever. You know, I was in my 20s, and I'd never performed ever, and I thought, wow, this is better than copy editing. You know, people liked it and they laughed and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just got this idea, which had never occurred to me at all, to be a performer. And then I was trying to figure out like how to do that. And then a friend of mine at the Phoenix, named Scott Rosenberg, brought me to see this fellow, Spalding Gray, who was performing at the Brattle Theater in Cambridge. Mm-hmm. And as it happens, he was performing a whole bunch of his stuff.
He was doing his own retrospective.
Yeah, retrospective.
Of his own work.
Of his own work. And I didn't
Monster
know.
In a Box.
Yeah, well, this was pre-Monster. This was like...
Oh, right. That would have been the one of his later works.
This would be in about 85. So
when he was doing the Killing Fields one.
It might even have been before Swimming to Cambodia.
Oh, Swimming to Cambodia.
But it was... So he was starting to get known, but he wasn't super-duper known. And I had not... I mean, relatively speaking, I hadn't heard of Spalding Gray before when I went to this. My friend Scott had actually had a date, you know, for that show. I wouldn't be a monologuist, you know, because he brought me instead. And
Spalding Gray rocked your world.
Yeah. And so I went and I saw him and I didn't know there was a form. I knew there was stand-up, but I didn't know, for comedy and person standing up and telling. But that didn't seem right for me. I just sort of intuitively felt like I wanted to tell longer stories and things like that. And then I saw Spalding Gray and I saw, you can do comic monologues that are in many aspects or even essentially comic, but it's not driven by the jokes. It's driven by the narrative. It's the experience of it is more like going to a play or reading a novel to me. And the audience especially was attentive, you know, and I mean the level, you know, a theater audience is a really, really brilliant thing. And so that just really that planted the scene in my mind. I had no history of acting or no experience or anything.
How'd you get your first one? What was your first monologue?
My first attempt to perform was about a month after that in Boston at a place called TT the Bear's Place. Mm-hmm. I had some friends who had
a Central Square.
Yeah,
I know. Just saying that. I did live there for a while, but
Central Square works for almost anything.
Yeah,
there, but,
just say
or Harvard Square
or Kenmore Square.
Kenmore Square. I had an office on Kenmore Square. That's in Boston. Yeah.
So I know.
I actually ran a newspaper for 7 issues called the Kenmore Comet.
Really?
Yeah.
You have them in a box in your
I do. I have three of each of the seven issues. And it had a great logo. It was a comet heading towards the Citgo sign.
Oh, yeah.
In Boston.
Oh, good.
Big Citgo
sign. Yeah, yes, sure.
So, oh, yeah. So, anyhow, my
right
first
Starro Drive or something?
What?
Right off Starro Drive or where? No, I don't. I just
started driving. So, yeah, driving stuff doesn't, but it was right by the T.
Okay.
Right by the T. So, anyhow, I did a performance. I just put together an improv, about a half hour, 20-minute improv at T.T. the Bear's place about, and I might have friends, you know, just whatever, you know, it was about what my dad had told me about communism and sex, you know, which almost always was the same things in my father's case that he would say about both issues. And so, and I did it, and, you know, it was scary and stuff. And
I bet.
There was a guy in the audience named Oliver Platt.
The actor.
Mm. Yeah. And he's a young guy there, and he was there on a really bad date, and he said, he came up to me after and said, oh, yeah, you're really cool. You know, we're starting this thing called the Graham Rudman Act that's like, you know, doing sketches. And, you know, why don't you audition for it? So I auditioned for it, and I did some stuff. And then that's when I first started trying out doing some stuff about me and my dad, you know, started developing that. And then a bunch of my friends from the Phoenix moved to San Francisco, and I moved there in 87. And then in 89, I did my first actual monologue, which was called Josh Crumbly's Daily World. And it was, again, as all my stuff is, developed improvisationally. And, you know, I invited some people, and then it got reviewed. And then I've been making a living from it since, not then, but since about 2 years after that.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's a great story.
Yeah, so... And it's really just sort of self, you know, self-taught, or sure. I've learned from my directors, learned
There's
from my audiences.
There's no classes for this, is there?
Yeah. There might be. I'm actually teaching one at Stanford now.
Oh, so. that's yeah. good. Because yeah. you Well, then I'm saying corrected. Because, I mean, we mostly know, as we've already mentioned, two of the maybe of the three or four most well-known. Mm-hmm. There's, of course, the Josh Kornbluth.
There's Josh Kornbluth, and then there's the
and
big
there's,
gap.
And then there's Eric Bogosian and, well... Spalding Gray. Anna Deavere Smith is probably...
Oh, these are some of my heroes. I mean, the people you name are some of my heroes. I had actually...
Who else?
Anybody else?
That maybe less known that should be known? Or maybe forgetting some of the...
Danny Hawk. Let's just say Danny Hawk. Have you ever seen Danny Hawk?
Yeah, and also...
H-O-C-H spelled.
Yeah, I have heard of his name.
I don't know what Danny... I mean, he's also an actor, a very successful actor in films and stuff like that, but he is...
Right. That's probably where I know him, boss.
Amazing. And he's... He was actually directed, I don't know if he still is, but directed by Eric Bogosian's director, who's also his wife.
Okay.
But Danny is in that genre of doing different characters, as, of course, Anna Deavere Smith is.
And so is another monologuist-turned-actor.
John Leguizamo?
John Leguizamo.
Yeah.
Who I also saw...
I saw him do it
very early on. I said, this guy's going to be a huge star.
Yeah, and he is.
Yeah, he really managed to...
No, I mean, they're all... Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of great people. There's there's a number of great people.
And I wonder if there's anybody who's done a lot of acting who maybe then ended up trying dipping their toe into monologuing.
There was a whole,
but I'm talking about people who really were monologuists, and then maybe, you know, like even Spalding Gray, of course, probably for many people might know him as an actor, not as a monologuist, except that
he was pretty open about that his main motivation was to get the health insurance. That's why he acted in films.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, there was a period when it seemed like a lot, and there maybe still be some, where a lot of actors were going, oh, you know, I'm going to do a one-person show.
Right. So. But a one-person show isn't, it could be a play that somebody else wrote.
It could be a play, it can even be about you that there's a genre, and some of these can be very good, but there's a genre of, you know, well, both where someone plays a historical figure, but there's also a genre where someone who's very famous... like who acted in Star Wars or something, does a one-person show about herself, you know? Mm-hmm. And there's that genre, too.
See who you're talking about.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah. You know, but I'm just saying, you know, like, or the olden days, Peter Ustinov, I mean, like, famous actors, famous people, and they were usually actors, I guess, because they're actors, and they would, you know, tour with shows. But that's also, to me, a slightly different genre, you know? This one, you know, what I do is sort of confessional... It's just a thing. I mean, I was inspired by Spalding Gray, and I think my own voice is really different. I think I'm way Jewisher than Spalding was.
He is the Uber Wasp in a way.
He was, yeah. Although he would always say that he didn't really know he was funny until he went to New York and Jews said he was funny.
Well, you know.
Yeah, I think he was probably shading the truth there, but
I have to say, I miss him.
You know, I miss him terribly,
and I never met him, and I never saw him live. And it's one of those very few, probably times where I thought I should have, you know, because certainly there were opportunities, and I thought about it, and I said I need to go see him. But and then I think that Soderbergh project was really powerful and moving. I was in tears on that. I thought he really did him a really great, nice eulogy that film.
Yeah, Soderbergh. I mean, Soderbergh had filmed
one
Spalding
of
Grey's Anatomy.
Grey's Anatomy.
And Spalding had acted in Soderbergh's one of his movies. You know, as an actor, and at least in one of his movies. And yeah, no, that was lovely. I saw him a lot because I really thought he was great. You know, and would always see him when I could. But also because his wife was my booking agent for a number of years.
Oh.
And so Kathy Russo. So I got to hang out and stuff. And
wow.
And I miss him terribly, and I've been sort of shocked. You know, I've been teaching an undergraduate class every year at Stanford, and for the last few years, none of my students, and these are like really smart kids who want to be in the theater, some of them wanted to be monologuists, and so far none of my students have ever heard of Spalding Gray.
It's a shame.
Yeah, so it's fleeting, this.
But then you introduce them to it, and then what is their reaction?
They like him.
Is it like blown away like, or is it?
Well, you know what? I'll tell you, it varies. It varies. I think they like him. It's not the same as seeing him live, obviously. To see, say, Swimming in Cambodia, the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a great concert film by Jonathan Demme, but it's not like seeing him live. But I also attend, the emotional center for me of so far my course has been another guy who's an actor, playwright, and occasional monologuist, who's Wally Shawn.
Mm.
And Wally Shawn's monologue, The Fever, which is actually, it's almost in a way opposite of Spalding Gray, opposite of what I do, in the sense that it's not about him. He's like, says it's not, although it's, you know, seems kind of, but basically it's meant, Wally Shawn wrote it to be performed by anyone, and it could be about anyone, and it's not like about, I, Wally Shawn, have this life, and this is my specific life. But what it is, it's a moral, it's a self-questioning about, bourgeois morality, you know. It's in front of, you know, by a person who knew that the audiences that he'd be saying this to
are bourgeois.
Right. By definition.
Kind of challenging them.
But I actually find for my students, you know, Wallace Shawn's The Fever tends to be, to me, the sort of emotionally deepest part of the course.
Well, I really would love to have a shot at talking to him.
I did. I interviewed him once.
You did?
Yeah. He speaks very slowly, or he did to me. And so I would get really nervous. And so I'd like ask him a question, and then there'd be a long pause. He was really nice, and his answers were great.
That works fine for this thing.
But I would get nervous. I also began on the wrong foot because, you know, I mentioned that of course he wasn't Jewish, you know, like, you know, some, and he said, well, my mother was Jewish and my father was Jewish. Does that count as Jewish? So, oh, okay.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. No, he was, he's really cool. And then, of course, when we can always visualize him saying inconceivable from Princess Bride.
Inconceivable.
Inconceivable. it's just amazing that little guy.
Yeah, I know.
You know, is this super uber serious.
So, right, a real erudite artist, intellectual scholar kind of.
Yeah.
I had on his former co-star of the Dinner film, Dinner With.
Oh, you had Andre?
I had Andre on the
Andre
show.
Gregory,
that was, Andre Gregory. And that was also a delight. So I feel like I need to have the entire cast on. So I need to get,
So Julianne Moore and there's a bunch. Yeah, they're all some great. I was thinking of the cast of Vanya on 42nd Street.
Another great film.
Yeah, but anyhow, that's what Julianne Moore's in. Julianne and
Moore.
That's
right there. Andre Gregory was in that too.
Yeah.
Let's remind everybody, because maybe I'll hold on to this until we have a little bit more of an East Coast, closer down to...
That'd be awesome. It'd be awesome if you could say, you know, like, add a thing in whatever your voice sounds like at that later time. You know, it might be husky.
Oh, I see. My huskier from my smoking.
Hard living.
Or
whatever.
The whiskey
Yeah.
problem.
It might be your son might do it at that point.
That's right.
Voice might be like this at that point.
So. That's right.
Yeah. So
well, hopefully it won't take that long because it would be great to see your work and or your next monologue in New York. I'll be looking forward to it.
I'd love to do both. I'm working on
how can people find out what you're doing and if it's going to come to New York? Is there a Josh
Kornbluth? There is a joshkornbluth.com.
Oh, dot com.
Com. Com for, you know, communist parents.
Dot commie.
Yeah, so Josh Kornbluth with a K, if that helps.
And Josh is the author or screenwriter and the star of this new film called Love and Taxes. And smartly marketing-wise, leaving out the third part of that phrase, usually, right?
Well, it's either death and taxes.
You know, but it's good to leave that out because most people marketing
or love and death or Woody Allen's love,
love
and death.
Death. Yes, that's true.
I'm actually working on my next theater
piece
covering death. I'm actually it's about I'm a volunteer at the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco.
Oh, fun!
And so people sometimes tend to shy, like start backing away from me when I say that's what I'm working on. But
I'm all for it. Yeah. Love and Taxes is the current project, though.
Yeah.
And coming soon to a city near you. Or a festival near you in the meantime. And maybe when you're coming through New York with the film, maybe we can pick it up from there if you want.
I'd love to.
And we'll get Jacob on, who's your brother and the director of the film.
The director of my film and the director of other films as well, including the documentary Inequality for All.
Yes, of course. That's
with
a good
Robert Reich, who is in our film.
Oh, he is. And
yes,
is there
Robert
a new
Reich.
One coming out on Robert Reich, right? Isn't there
he's
a new
working
one?
On, that's
he's
why he's
on
not
new
here
one.
At the festival.
Right,
at the
right.
Festival.
Okay.
He's working on a second.
That's right. That's why I heard from
it's
Brian.
It's a title that would my father, my communist father, would roll over in his grave, Saving Capitalism. But then I think it's for the rest
Moore
of us.
Like rolling over without having seen. But I understand people are rolling over from seeing his new film. I don't know. I haven't seen it, so I can't criticize it. But
looking forward to it.
But me too. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun to meet you.
Same here.
Thank you.
We just need to get you back into the system.
And just like that, I was in the system. People started being drawn to me.
Hi.
Hi.
I had fans.
I would love to option this for a major motion picture.
Girlfriend, garden, options, why? All I can think of is it's because I filed.
I didn't expect this enormous tax hit.
Actually, it's worse than that. You still owe $15,000.
You have this ginormous tax problem. And I really need you to solve it so that the IRS doesn't swoop in and take my stuff.
But you don't have any stuff.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to episode number 394 of the podcast. Please do, of course, subscribe on iTunes, leave us a nice star rating and review on iTunes, go to Facebook, and please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/filmwaxradio. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram by searching for us at Filmwax Radio. Very simple, can't be easier than that. And of course, for all things Filmwax Radio, do visit us at filmwaxradio.com. And please feel free to reach out and say hello. You can reach me through the website. There is a link to our email on the homepage, and would love to hear from you, those who listen to the show, with your thoughts, feelings, suggestions, anything that's on your mind. Until next time, we'll be back, of course, with a brand new episode next week. Until then, of course, take care of yourself and the ones you love.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads, people sleeping in broken beds. Ain't no use jiving, ain't no use joking. Everything is broken. With broken hearts.